Welcome back to the Outlaw History Podcast. I haven't done a new episode in a few weeks, and that's entirely my fault. We're going to get into why. I have enough guests lined up for several months worth of podcasts, but I have simply not been on task lately. And I apologize to my listeners and to all the wonderful people who have agreed to come on the podcast and been kind enough to send me print materials. Right now, and I'm recording this on a Monday, my goal is to record several podcasts this week and to release two or three per week until I feel that I have made it up to all of you. So there are going to be some really good episodes coming your way very soon. The next bit that I'm going to say is something that I went back and forth on because it's personal and because people can turn personal things against you very easily. I thought about maybe doing it as an exclusive for Patreon supporters. But, you know, whatever. I pride myself on honesty, and I want to be honest with my listeners. So I want to give a brief rundown of my past few years and why I ended up sort of the way that I am. I was in graduate school, as most of you know. It's an ordeal for the best of us, and I am far from the best of us. I got through my PhD coursework okay, but I was just really terrified of comps. And my mental health got to be in a very bad place. By the time I started to rebound from that, my mother was sick. My mother died of lung cancer last year. She would have turned 66 yesterday as I'm recording this. The whole time all of this has been going on, I was also dealing with some pretty challenging physical problems that I am still dealing with. I have some nerve problems in my lower back. It's hard for me to get around, and it's even hard for me to sit down for long periods. Which is quite a problem when you read and write for a living. The problem became really pronounced when I was preparing for comps and made that experience much more difficult. And those of you who have taken PhD exams know that that entire process is bad enough on its own. And I struggled a lot, but I finally passed comps this past February. Then I immediately had a book review to write, I had a conference paper to write, I had a TEDx talk to prepare for. And then it was the race to finish grading for the semester. And then we were moving, and then my dad was in the hospital, and I was traveling back and forth to Arkansas. So now I'm in a position where I need to find a job, I need to finish my dissertation proposal, I need to start doing a better job of the podcast, I need to get rolling on some other projects that I really want to do, but I suffer from chronic depression, and I'm easily overwhelmed, and when I start feeling overwhelmed, I become completely useless. Depression saps my work ethic when it gets its hooks into me before I can distract myself with work or wrestling or reading or something else. So I'm fighting really hard to get through this rough patch, and I want to get my own economic uncertainty to be somewhat less uncertain, and I really want to find a way to finish my dissertation. There was some discussion on Twitter last week about who does and doesn't get to call themselves historians. And here's the thing, I know that I've earned the right to call myself a historian. I have paid my dues, I passed PhD comps in history, and anyone who's done that knows that's, you have proven yourself at that point. But I really want to finish the dissertation, I really want to finish the PhD, and it's not because I want to get a job in academia. I am really quite ambivalent about being an academic. But it's very important for me to establish myself as a historian, because that's the only thing that I've really wanted to be my entire life. So for those of you who have stuck with me, who reach out to me, who try to make sure I'm doing okay and taking care of myself, thank you, and I'm going to try really hard to make your efforts worthwhile. Anyway, thanks for listening to all that. The rest of the episode is going to be dedicated to answering questions from my Twitter followers that I should have answered a month ago, but better late than never, I guess. And if you guys like this, we can make it a regular thing. So if you want to ask me a question to answer on the podcast, tweet me at Outlaw Historian with the hashtag AskOutlaw. You can also email me questions at outlawhistorian@gmail.com. Put AskOutlaw in the subject line. One last thing before we jump into these questions. As always, please consider supporting me on Patreon. That is patreon.com/outlawhistory. Also, subscribe to the podcast, follow me on Twitter, all of that good stuff. And now, the first edition of Ask Outlaw. First question here is, what's the most interesting feud for Jon Moxley? That being the former Dean Ambrose, who has left WWE to become a professional wrestler again. Outside of The Shield, I was never a big fan of Dean Ambrose because of the horrible way they booked him in WWE, but I am already a huge Jon Moxley fan. I can't wait to see him wrestle Kenny Omega. I can't wait to see him in the G1. I was really into his first couple of New Japan shows. He had a match with Juice Robinson where he won the IWGP US Heavyweight title. And then a few days later, he wrestled Shota Umino in an opening match, beat him quickly, and then cut a fantastic promo declaring that Shota was going to be his new young boy. And look this stuff up on YouTube, Jon Moxley's New Japan promos, because they're really fantastic. He reminds me of Terry Funk, and if you know the way that I feel about Terry Funk, you know that's a huge compliment. So yeah, I can't wait to see everything Moxley is going to be getting into going forward. James Buchanan, the second worst president in United States history, asked, how could the Civil War have been avoided? Well, Buck, I can't really put this one on you. I think the only way the Civil War could have been avoided would have been if slavery had somehow ended before the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Once this country was established with compromises between large sections of the country where slavery was legal in half and illegal in the other half, that there was going to be conflict. And I'm pretty against determinist views of history, but I don't know how else to say that. Someone asked, what animal would you most like to have a pocket-sized version of? Okay, you didn't say that it had to be a non-extinct animal, so I'm going to go with a Tyrannosaurus Rex. I mean, how sweet would that be? You know, pocket-sized Tyrannosaurus. Jason asks, which houses would the top Civil War figures belong to? Lincoln, Grant, Sherman, all Gryffindors. Stonewall Jackson is a Hufflepuff. Robert E. Lee and Henry Halleck are Ravenclaws. Jefferson Davis and George McClellan were total Slytherins. It's fun. I should write something about this sometime, sorting Civil War generals into their houses. Rebecca Faulkner asks, the best non-school book you've read lately? I don't know what constitutes a non-school book, since so much of the stuff that I read for my own enjoyment also benefits my life as a historian. But I just read, finally, I had never read it, I just read Confederates in the Attic by Tony Horowitz, who, rest in peace, he just passed away a few weeks ago. And I can't recommend this book highly enough. It looks directly into the heart of the Lost Cause, and I think it's critically important for anyone who really wants to understand why Southerners feel the way they do about the Civil War and its memory. James W.J. Robinson asks, Sherman burning Atlanta memes, funny or fucked up? Hilarious. My favorite is the one that's a picture of Sherman that says SEC champion 1864-65. My good friend Panda asks, who is Hiromu's best boyfriend? That being Hiromu Takahashi of New Japan Pro Wrestling, who we all hope to see back in the ring very soon. Dragon Lee is absolutely Hiromu's best boyfriend. They are wrestling soulmates. Jeff Glossner, my former colleague, asked, why do you think military history is still important? Nick Mosvik and I talked about this in the first episode of the podcast. I said, and I believe, that war is the chaos that creates the continuity in history. And you do not understand war if you do not understand the military side of war. War and society history is all well and good. I consider myself a war and society historian, but there is no war in society without war. Raimundo Reyes Quesada asks, what famous American pre-1900 would make the best heel character? I had to think about this one for a second. I'm going to go with William Byrd, who was an 18th century Virginia planter and founder of the city of Richmond, who kept diaries about how he abused his slaves, and this man was an absolute sadist. So go look him up if you like having nightmares. Dr. Neri Bakalian asks, among the Civil War generals, who would win in a drinking contest? I say that depends on whether Mrs. Grant is around or not. Tristan, my outstanding co-host from a couple of episodes ago, asked, where do you stand on Fantastic Beasts? I love the first movie. Have some problems with the second one. I have some questions about the revelation at the end of Crimes of Grindelwald that Credence is a lost Dumbledore brother. If that doesn't turn out to be a lie by Grindelwald, it's going to create some serious continuity problems in the larger Harry Potter franchise. And I rewatched about 45 minutes of the second movie the other night, and there's a lot of silly storytelling, and I just wasn't that into it. When Grindelwald's gang shows up in Paris and they kill the Muggle family, and they're establishing their headquarters and they find the baby, and it's clearly meant to be a callback to Voldemort and Harry Potter from the original series. And then one of Grindelwald's henchwomen just murders the baby. So we've established Grindelwald's gangs are bad guys with the gratuitous and unnecessary baby murderer. And also immediately established that Grindelwald is a way more competent villain than Voldemort. Jarrett Rominski, a fellow scholar of loyalty in the Civil War South, asked, was Bret Hart better than Shawn Michaels? Bret Hart was a better wrestler. Shawn Michaels was a better overall performer. Tamara D asks, what house are you in? I am a Hufflepuff. I am a proud Hufflepuff. Sandra Swan, who wants to ban the Nazis, and we here at the Outlaw History Podcast fully support banning Nazis, asks, Dumbledore, hero, anti-hero, or villain? Dumbledore is a hero, but he's also an absolute sociopath. Dumbledore is an extremely Machiavellian character, very much the ends justify the means. But after his youthful mistakes, he was always on the right side. And one thing that I noticed when I watched back a little bit of The Crimes of Grindelwald the other night was that the first appearance of Dumbledore is establishing him as maddeningly unhelpful despite being very demanding of his followers. I think that that's sort of actually a good fleshing out of Dumbledore's character, but we'll see where the rest of the franchise goes and if they can clean up some of the issues that I was having rewatching The Crimes of Grindelwald the other night. Rookie City Sergeant asks, is a hot dog a sandwich? Follow up, is a hot dog a taco? Yes, a hot dog is a sandwich. No, it is not a taco. Tacos have tortilla shells, not bread. And I got into an argument with my wife the other day. She says that tortillas are unleavened bread, which is probably right, but I don't buy it. There's a reason why they're called tortillas, and no, a hot dog is not a taco. Cherise Blackney asks, as a follow-up to that question, is ketchup jelly? I'm upset by this question, Cherise. Jeff Strom asks, what's your take on barbecue? Kansas City, Memphis, Carolina? Memphis for pork, Texas for beef. And if I happen to travel to your area, please treat me to the local barbecue and I will continue to adjust my views as necessary. Really, anything for free barbecue. Just buy me barbecue. If you are within the sound of my voice, if you ever have the opportunity to buy me barbecue, you should seize it. David Smalley asks, what was more important to Union victory, Vicksburg or Gettysburg? Now this goes back to that age-old question, was the war won in the East or the West? And the answer is yes. Politically, the war was won in the East. Militarily, it was won in the West. Richard Miller asked, Harry Potter versus Andre the Giant? I'm going to say that depends. Is it a young, spry Andre or old, immobile Andre? I think at any point after 1986, Harry can take him. It would be sort of akin to the battle between young Harry and the mountain troll in Philosopher's Stone / Sorcerer's Stone. Swoop John B. asked, why does WWE keep pushing Brock Lesnar? He's the only guy in the company who can stay over as a major star because he's not around enough for them to kill his heat. Lost in the Nexus asks, most overrated general in the Civil War and most underrated. Most overrated is Nathan Bedford Forrest. Thanks for that, Shelby Foote. Most underrated, I think, is Samuel Ryan Curtis, but being that Curtis is the Union general who ran the Confederacy out of Arkansas, I might be a bit biased. Glenn Berry asked, how important do you think the Battle of Hampton Roads was to the overall Civil War? That, of course, being the duel between the USS Monitor and the CSS Virginia, formerly known as the USS Merrimack. The duel between the two boats was tactically inconclusive, strategically insignificant, And as far as I can recall, not especially significant operationally. But it's a very important development in naval history, the first duel between ironclads. And a minor point there, the Virginia was, in fact, an ironclad ship. The Monitor was an iron warship. Monitor was built from iron from the keel up. The Virginia and other ironclads were wooden ships clad in iron. There were other types of clad ships in the Civil War, tin clads and even cotton clads. It were wooden ships with material added on for extra protection. Josh asks, is there a match or matches that you never get tired of watching? There are a lot of matches that I've enjoyed on multiple viewings, but these days there's so much wrestling to watch that I rarely rewatch much of anything. Unless I just... If I watch a match and then I really feel like I didn't get as much out of it as maybe other people did, I'll wonder if, well, maybe it deserves a rewatch, and sometimes I will. But there's way too much current wrestling, and there's way too much classic wrestling to be rewatching the same matches over and over again, I think. Unless, you know, watch what you enjoy. My goal is to see as much different stuff as possible. So I don't rewatch stuff unless it's for a specific reason. Or if it's been a long time. Wayne asks, who is the bigger dunce, Gideon Pillow or Leonidas Polk? Leonidas Polk was the dunce who violated Kentucky's neutrality and pretty much assured that Kentucky wouldn't join the Confederacy. So I'm going to go with Leonidas Polk. I'm going to do one more Ask Outlaw question, and then I'm going to do sort of a lights out segment on the back end of the podcast. Everywhere Josh asks, do you consider the Mexican-American War a prelude to the American Civil War or a standalone, and why? Thank you for the question, Josh. It gives me a chance to make an important point. Nothing in history is a standalone event. That is the most important lesson that I can teach a student or anyone else about history. There is no such thing as a standalone historical event. I've been reading Edward Hallett Carr's What is History as a way to sort of better understand the nature of my profession, and one point he makes is that not everything that happened in the past is a historical event. It is not a historical event until someone historicizes it. If someone historicizes a past event, it is relevant for some reason. If it's relevant for some reason, then that means that it connects to other events. This came up a lot when I was helping students as a TA, and it's something that I'll emphasize if and when I get the chance to teach my own classes. Historical events do not happen in a vacuum. Anything that can be considered a historical event connects to other historical events, sort of by definition. So there's our first Q&A session. I enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed it. Tweet me at Outlaw Historian and let me know if you loved it, hated it, want more of it in the future. Never want it again, etc., etc. Now, I was content to end the podcast on that note, but it came up kind of short. I didn't want to shortchange you guys. I really wanted to give you at least about 30 minutes this time around. So I put out a call on Twitter for a few more questions, and someone brought up a question about Great Britain's role in the American Civil War. And that reminded me that I actually wrote my high school senior term paper on England's role in the American Civil War. And other than like one that I hand wrote in sixth grade, this would have been the first paper that I ever wrote about the Civil War. And I said, kind of as a joke, who dares me to read my high school term paper on the podcast? So I'm going to read this just verbatim. And again, I wrote this when I was 16, 17 years old. So it's not anything that I would call good, but I just thought it might be kind of interesting to read this and maybe over time read some of my other papers and maybe get a sense of how I have grown and developed as a writer and a historian over the course of my life. So in my high school, if I remember correctly, the way it worked was that senior English, you studied English literature. And my English teacher, Miss Roberts, rest in peace, she was a great teacher. If any of my fellow Crossout High School alumni are listening to this, I'm sure you remember her. She had a list of topics that we could choose from our term papers, and she would put it out at like, so first period started at 8 in the morning, so she had a list that we could come by her classroom starting at 7:30, and we could essentially sign up or call dibs on the topic we wanted. So I made sure to get there early so I could sign up to do England's role in the American Civil War, since that was the only Civil War topic, and it was what I wanted to do. So the title of this paper is very creatively England and the American Civil War. The date on this, so the date that I turned it in, was December 14th, 2004. And here's the paper. In April 1861, the United States declared a state of insurrection against the Confederacy of rebellious Southern states. In Europe, the ordeal was referred to as the American question. The question could not be evaded. A choice had to be made between neutrality and intervention. European attitudes toward the American Civil War would have a significant effect on the war's ultimate outcome. Throughout the early months of the conflict, the reaction of Europe was of great interest to both sides, Queen Victoria's Great Britain in particular. Would Queen Victoria recognize Confederate independence? Such recognition would legitimize the Confederacy and provide it with allies who could furnish weapons and supplies the Southern cause desperately needed. At the outbreak of the war, most foreigners were poorly informed about America. According to Leslie Stephen in 1865, the name of America 5 years ago called up to the ordinary English mind nothing but a vague cluster of associations compounded of Mrs. Trollope, Martin Chuzzlewit, and Uncle Tom's Cabin. The choice between neutrality and intervention was not an easy one. Either choice would lead to more choices. The question dealt with several issues, and it was difficult to read the conflict amidst threatening demands of angry belligerents. England had to guess the future in order to make a wise decision while balancing interests at home. Europe's three greatest powers were England, France, and Russia. England and France had won control of Central and Eastern Europe by defeating Russia in the Crimean War, 1854-1856, and now salivated at the prospect of a possible downfall of the United States government. Russia, on the other hand, needed the United States to balance its European enemies. Britain, however, was the biggest concern of the warring factions across the Atlantic. Neither side wanted Britain to remain strictly neutral. The Union wanted Britain to deny belligerent status to the Confederacy, and the Confederacy wanted open intervention on their behalf. Queen Victoria issued her proclamation of British neutrality on May 13, 1861. She did, however, acknowledge the Confederacy as belligerents. This recognition gave the Confederacy the ability to purchase arms from neutral nations and seize ships on open oceans. The war had a direct impact on the United States' foreign relations. The most important of these relations was with Great Britain and France, Europe's two greatest powers. Queen Victoria's recognition of the Confederates as belligerents was viewed as an unfriendly act by United States President Abraham Lincoln's administration. The ruling class of Britain and France clearly sympathized with the Confederacy so strongly that they might have been easily convinced to intervene with force of arms and bring about Southern independence. Both countries were monarchies, and under normal circumstances, monarchies do not like to see a rebellion succeed in any land, as the example may prove contagious. But the South was an aristocracy, and aristocrats shared a common bond. The fact that the Confederacy was largely democratic could be easily overlooked from across the Atlantic. French and English aristocrats had always been unhappy about the success of Yankee democracy. Europe's rulers would have been pleased if the nation showed that democracy could not hold it together. For years, the South and England had been close in business as well as society. Southern planters and English gentry were seen as equivalents. English aristocrats believed that America and Europe both would receive a much-needed check to democracy with a Confederate victory. English liberals also favored the South, as they likened the South's desire to escape northern tyranny to the national aspirations of Germany and Italy. The London Times newspaper was also pro-Southern. There were also large segments of British opinion that favored the North. Many English manufacturers favored the North due to their strong business ties. The British Anti-Slavery Society found it difficult to sympathize with the Confederacy. Friends of democracy saw the United States as a model to be cherished, and the more radical ones saw the Southern insurrection as a blatant attempt to divide the United States. Leaders of the British labor movement also sided with the North. It was with a reasonable hope for success that in May 1861 the infant Confederacy looked for support abroad. Delegates were sent to Britain, France, Russia, Belgium, Spain, Mexico, Ireland, the Pope, and other world powers with orders from the Confederate government to present the nature and purposes of the Confederate cause, to open diplomatic relations, and to negotiate treaties of friendship, commerce, and navigation. The North was correct in its belief that neither Britain nor France would ever condone slavery, the South's peculiar institution, But until late 1862, when Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation, slavery was not an open issue. When the conflict began, the federal government had made it clear that they were fighting only to preserve the Union. If a Southern emissary wanted to convince the European governments that they could aid the Confederacy without condoning slavery, he could cite the federal government's own words to prove his case. There was no moral issue as far as Europe was concerned, so the power politics game could be played with a clear conscience. The Union saw the rebellion in the South as an irresponsible insurrection and wished for Britain to do the same. United States Secretary of State William Seward said that the South's pretend government should not be recognized as having belligerent rights. However, in the eyes of Europe, the Confederacy was seen as a responsible government conducting war. In the summer of 1862, the Confederacy looked like a winner. In a speech given on October 7, 1862, William E. Gladstone, the Chancellor of Exchequer, said, "There is no doubt that Jefferson Davis and the other leaders of the South have made an army. They are making, it appears, a navy. And they have made, what is more than either, they have made a nation. We may anticipate with certainty the success of the Southern states so far as regards to their separation from the North." Confederate diplomats sent to Britain were unable to secure full recognition of the Confederate government. They were disappointed when Britain refused to denounce the Union blockade of Southern ports. Britain denied Confederate privateers the use of foreign ports, and Confederate hopes of open intervention from England were deferred. The diplomats bickered amongst themselves and felt that they had been snubbed, and they were soon relieved. In 1858, James Hammond of South Carolina said that without Southern cotton, quote, "England would topple headlong and carry the whole civilized world with her." Hammond was mistaken. New sources of cotton emerged in Egypt and India, so the loss of Southern cotton was a far less concern than the loss of the lucrative Northern wartime market. The Emancipation Proclamation destroyed the Confederacy's hope for recognition of independence in Europe. No foreign power would side against a nation that was fighting to destroy slavery. Europe refused to take part in America's conflict, and North and South were left to fight it out between themselves. In the fall of 1861, a hot-headed United States naval officer, Captain Charles Wilkes, made a brash decision and got a bigger reaction than the United States was prepared to handle. European recognition was critical to the young Confederacy, and there were great tensions between the United States and Great Britain. The issue almost exploded into all-out war over what came to be known as the Trent Affair. On the night of October 11, 1862, a Confederate blockade runner slipped out of the Charleston Harbor during a storm. The ship was carrying Confederate diplomats James Mason and John Slidell. Mason was bound for London, Slidell for Paris. Their mission was to seek official recognition of the Confederate government. The Confederate ship docked in Havana, Cuba, and the Confederate diplomats transferred to the Trent, a British steamer headed for England. At the same time, the USS San Jacinto was returning to the United States from a long tour of duty along the coast of Africa. She put in at a Cuban port looking for news about Confederate raiders reportedly active in the area, when Captain Wilkes heard about Mason and Slidell. It was generally agreed that a nation at war had the right to stop and search a neutral ship if the ship was suspected of carrying enemy dispatches. In a novel interpretation of international law, Wilkes reasoned that Mason and Slidell were in effect Confederate dispatches, and it was his right to remove them. The Trent met up with the San Jacinto in the Bahama Channel on November 8, 1861. Wilkes fired twice across the Trent's bow and sent a boarding crew aboard. Mason and Slidell were seized and imprisoned in Boston Harbor's Fort Warren. Wilkes was hailed as a hero in the North. Congress voted him its thanks for his brave, adroit, and patriotic conduct in the arrest of the traitors. Even the ordinarily cautious Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, warmly commended Wilkes. Queen Victoria, on the other hand, was outraged. Many English citizens called for war against the United States. Sympathy for the Confederacy grew in Britain. 8,000 British soldiers were sent to Canada, and the Royal Navy was placed on war footing. Lord Palmerston, the British Prime Minister, issued an ultimatum: release Mason and Slidell or face war with Great Britain. The London Times wrote, "By Captain Wilkes, let the Yankee breed be judged. Swagger and ferocity built on a foundation of vulgarity and cowardice, these are the characteristics and these are the prominent marks by which his countrymen, generally speaking, are now known all over the world." U.S. Secretary of War Seward thought that the seceded states would come back to the Union if a war with Britain occurred, but President Lincoln said, quote, "one war at a time." The Union needed the 2,300 tons of saltpeter, a key ingredient in making gunpowder, that had secretly been purchased from Britain. Lincoln sought a face-saving reconciliation. Lincoln recognized that Mason and Slidell had been taken illegally and agreed to release them. The diplomats were released into British custody on New Year's Day, 1862. An apology was issued, and the Trent affair ended on an anticlimactic note. At the outbreak of the war, the commander of the Union Army was aging General Winfield Scott. Scott was a Virginian by birth, but he was a devoted Union man. Scott's response to the insurrection was a strategic plan that he relayed in a letter to General George McClellan in May 1861. "We rely greatly on the sure operation of a complete blockade of the Atlantic and Gulf ports soon to commence. In connection with such a blockade, we propose a powerful movement down the Mississippi to the ocean, with a cordon of posts at proper points, the object being to clear out and keep open this great line of communication in connection with the strict blockade of the seaboard, so as to envelop the insurgent states and bring them to terms with less bloodshed by any other plan." Scott's Anaconda plan would split the Confederacy in two and lead to its economic strangulation. Lincoln himself thought the plan was too mild, but he saw the wisdom in Scott's plan and ordered the blockade. And the blockade would prove to be the ultimate base for the defeat of the Confederacy. British manufacturers needed cotton. They knew that the blockade would close southern ports to trade, so British shipbuilders began building blockade runners. These cruisers were small and fast, built to slip past Union ships into southern points to deliver English goods and load up with cotton to take back to Britain. Confederate Navy Captain James Bullock promoted the building of many of these cruisers. Bullock was in England for the sole purposes of having cruisers built. During his time in England, Bullock promoted the building of the Alabama, the Florida, and several other Confederate cruisers. The British government seized the Alexandria, a raider intended for the Confederacy, on April 5, 1863. The Alexandria was seized because it was apparently intended for the Confederacy. Other raiders, such as the Alabama and the Florida, had been allowed to escape due to a lack of conclusive evidence that they were so intended. The Confederate defeats at Antietam, Gettysburg, and Vicksburg had lost the South any chance of official recognition from Great Britain, and the seizure of the Alexandria made it apparent that Britain planned to enforce its position of neutrality. After the war, there were still some issues between the United States and Great Britain to be settled. The Alabama claims were filed against Great Britain by the United States for damage inflicted upon northern merchant ships during the war by Confederate raiders that had been built, fitted, or otherwise aided by British interest. A joint commission of Great Britain, the United States, and three neutral countries met in May 1871 to settle the claims and other unresolved issues between the two world powers. Secretary of State Hamilton Fish brought forth the Treaty of Washington for arbitration. The United States was awarded $15.5 million in damages for all of the direct losses caused by the Alabama and the Florida, and for more direct losses caused by the Shenandoah. The arbitrators threw out American claims for indirect losses, and Britain was absolved in the blame of several less important raiders. Throughout the course of America's internal conflict, Great Britain had much involvement. British interests helped to finance ships that harassed Union shipping, and the Trent Affair almost caused a full-scale war between the United States and Britain. If Britain had chosen to aid the Southern cause, Confederate independence may have been secured. The outcome of the American Civil War was significantly impacted by the attitudes of European powers.
I gotta tell you, reading that 15 years later is really quite embarrassing. I guess it wasn't bad for a high school senior, but, you know, me reading it back all these years later, having bachelor's and master's degrees and having done PhD work in history, I can't believe that I wrote that. It's very simple, very reductionist. But if any of you listeners are high school teachers, tweet me and tell me, you know, if this sounds like suitable work for your students. Because I remember I think I got a 98 out of 100 on this. So apparently it was good for the time and the place, but it's just kind of embarrassing to read now as a trained Civil War historian. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for bearing with me if you, in fact, managed to bear with me through that struggle. One more time, the Patreon is patreon.com/outlawhistory. If you want to make direct donations, you can do that at paypal.me/upaytray, T-R-A-E. Thanks as always to producer Chris and graphic designer Hecht. This has been the Outlaw History Podcast, and I will talk to y'all again after a while.